Okay, so as promised, I wanted to spend a little bit more time together contemplating some of the Buddha's teachings on karma, especially given some of the events over the last couple of weeks, with particular regard not to individual karma or personal karma, but to collective karma. And just as one of the core teachings in regard to insight into your own past karma as information on how to avoid recreating the unwholesome. Oh, gone, bye-bye, I'm sorry. we'll have to work sometime, not in the middle of a talk, to sort out what's going on with the system. Okay, so some of the high points that we've talked about in here so far. First off, once again, the term, the complete Sanskrit term is karma vipaka, which means action and result, or action and fruition. So, and the simile that the Buddha most frequently used was the planting of a seed and its germination and its nourishment, and then the fruition, okay, the fruit of the plant that's created by the germinating of the seed, carrying within it the seeds of the next generation of the plant. And so what it is not a thing, it's a continuous and ongoing process. So that's pretty much how I prefer to refer to this teaching, insofar as how it's actually manifesting in our lives. Okay. It's something that's going on all the time. When we are unconscious of the fact that it's going on, we unconsciously recreate the same karma that we've been stamping out a mile a minute since before we were born. Okay. And that includes both the wholesome or the good things we've done, but it also includes the unwholesome and destructive and painful things that we've done. Right? So a lot of what the practice of insight meditation is about is awakening to the habit patterns, all of the things that happened to us in our past, all the things that we may have done as a result in terms of actions of body, speech, and mind, and what fruits those actions bore. So the practice of insight meditation, to a pretty remarkable extent, when the mind becomes settled and things begin to arise in the mind, especially thoughts and feelings, okay, they tend to be, for the most part, related to the past. Something that's, you know, Gil Franzel and others talk about different forms of karma in terms of karma associated, sort of instant karma, you do something and there's immediate result. The karma based upon memory, the coming to mind of past actions and events, and the effect that they had on you, the effect that your actions had on others, okay. There's karma that's associated with the body and what the body remembers of past events, the memories we carry in the body and how they manifest and how we are. So the awakening to our karmic conditioning makes it less likely, when we can gain some insight into unwholesome things that we may have done in the past or that may have been done to us. Once that insight is gained, once we recognize the cause and effect relationship between the unskillful action or word or deed and its fruition, the outcome that it had, okay, then we can start to wake up to the process, which in turn, as we awaken, makes it less likely that we're going to replicate that process going forward. So for that reason, you know, when the Buddha, you hear the phrase frequently, you know, guilt and responsibility cannot exist in the same place. And what's meant by that is that if you find yourself reminiscing or reflecting on unwholesome words and deeds of your own in the past, and the unfortunate karmic consequences of it, if you're thinking back on those things, if you're remembering, if you're reflecting upon them from the perspective of self, then there is this the kinds of thoughts that tend to arise in the mind are things like, what a terrible person I am. You know, I don't deserve to live on this earth. That was awful. Who was I to have done such a thing? You know. So when the Buddha talked about looking at things in that point of view, he said, whether it's the point of view of self-recrimination, I'm worse than everybody else, or better than, you know, I'm actually morally superior to everybody else, or the same as, he said, all of those are kind of delusory perspectives because they're all based on an idea of self. So the feeling of guilt for past unskillful actions is based on the concept of me, I did those things, okay, which is in turn linked to the idea of a permanent and abiding self, okay, which is the opposite of what the Buddha taught, which was anatta, or not self. Okay. So one way of understanding the whole process, the whole karmic process, is the process of continuous self-construction that's going on all the time. Okay. When you awaken to that process, okay, then every once in a while you can get sufficient insight that the process ceases. You can see the mind selfing away, creating the self. At other times, once you really bring it more clearly into focus, the mind can just stop doing it for a little while. Just knock off the selfing. You know, what the Buddha called the I-making and the me-making. When that happens, there's a basic shift that occurs in terms of your relationship to your own karma. And instead of thinking, oh, look at this terrible thing that I did back then, okay, it's more like, oh my goodness, look at the thoughts, the words, the deeds that ensued from whoever I was at that point in time. So like on my computer, there's this function called Time Machine. And what it does is every hour or so, it kind of takes a snapshot of everything that's going on the hard drive of your computer. And it's on a separate little drive out there so that in the event that something really bad happens to your computer, then you've got this series of memories in there. And if you have to, you know, rebuild or restore your computer, you can go back to one of these recent snapshots and load it back onto your computer again. So for me, it's a little bit like that. It's like the mind is taking these snapshots of self, and who self was at that point in time, and what self did at that point in time. So if you can think about the past words, deeds, actions, not just, oh, look what a terrible thing I did then, it's, oh, look what ensued from the thoughts, the words, the deeds of whoever I was at that point in time. That, in turn, can then be followed with some sense or feeling of compassion for who you were at that point in time that caused you to say or do what you did. Okay. It's a completely different relationship to your own history, okay, and to the things that you may have said or done out of a sense of anger or ill will or fear or craving, okay, or just straight up delusion. So it's a much kinder and more loving relationship with your own past. but it also carries with it a significant amount of responsibility. I've had Dharma students over the years tell me that they actually have kind of mixed feelings about having learned how to gain insights into their own past behavior, because they feel now like they have more responsibility going forward because they have a keener understanding of what the impact of their thoughts and their words and their deeds is going to be in the future. Okay. So it causes us to speak and to act with more care, right? A little more consideration, a little more reflection, which is not a bad thing. Okay. So that's sort of the nature of our relationship to our karma in terms of our individual responsibility. And the Buddha said, just as important as it is for you when you're sitting, if you have twinges of remorse or sadness or something like that that come up when you remember unskillful things you said or done in the past, he said, out of a sense of balance, it's equally important for you to likewise bring to mind deeds, words, thoughts that you had that were born of wholesome intention, that did not ensue from a mind state that was infused with greed, hate, or delusion, but rather one that is informed by generosity, that's informed by goodwill, and that's informed by wisdom. And the reason he said it's just, he said you should reflect on your good deeds. Okay. And the reason for doing that is so that it kind of disempowers the notion of the coming to mind of the thoughts of guilt, rather. It's saying, just as you can see the relationship, you know, the karmic process between unskillful deeds and words in the past and the pain that you may have caused to others, the pain you may be feeling now, actually, in terms of remorse. He said, so too is it really important to be mindful of the positive effects that the Dharma is having on your personality, that is having on your state of being. Okay. Because when you do that, when you look at words and deeds, things you've done that were based on generosity, that were based on insight and wisdom, okay, that were based on kind regard for yourself and others, were based on compassion, then the fruition of those is what continues to encourage you to stay in that path, to continue to move in that direction. And so it's kind of like charting your course in the future. You know, the Buddha said for the unenlightened, for the uninquisitive, you know, amongst us in the world, the ones who really don't sort of care about these issues one way or another, okay. He said that they are like a herd of cows being driven home by the end of the day, you know. They are drawn by their desires and driven by their fears, right? They're drawn by the craving to get back to the barn and get something to eat. They're driven by the cowherd hitting them with a stick. And he said that in order to not be among those, for your life to not simply be one where you're drawn forward by craving and driven by fear or anger or anxiety or whatever, that it's so important to awaken to the active role that you're playing in all this, okay? So that you can kind of get free from that particular chain of causality. So, just as that relationship to our karma certainly happens at the individual level, likewise happens at the social level, okay? The societal level, at the cultural level. So, we as a nation have inherited some very interesting karma, I guess is one way to put it, you know. of both kinds, you know, both the unwholesome and the wholesome, right? That I think it may be worth our reflecting on for a few minutes. Before making that transition, however, from the personal to the social, I'm wondering if there are any thoughts or reflections or questions that anybody has about anything that I've said so far. Yes, please.
One of the most comforting things that anyone could tell me in my life was, you made the best decision at the time with the facts you knew.
Exactly.
And that's what you're talking about.
Quite so. Because it allows you to relate to yourself with kind regard, yeah. A sense of forgiveness, and some sense of confidence in yourself. You know, we're all just really kind of doing the best we can, except when we don't. So I want to particularly focus for just a few minutes on the question of race relations in the United States. And that story goes back to the time when the very first Europeans arrived on the shores of what we now call the Americas. Because what the Europeans started doing from the very get-go was enslaving the indigenous peoples they found here. Some of whom had been enslaving each other for a while, so it's not as if it was an unknown phenomenon, but the European colonists did it with a vengeance and on an unprecedented scale. And it was an institution that was a part of American society from the very earliest founding of the colonies. Okay. Some of them were slave states, the original colonies, from the very beginning, dating back to the 1600s. So at the time that we decided that we wanted to separate from Great Britain, and become our own nation, there are these ideals of freedom and liberty, you know, that everybody really rallied around insofar as the driving political force to go ahead and go to war with the world's most powerful nation, England. And we had these founding documents by people like Thomas Jefferson, you know. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all free white adult male property owners are It's not exactly what he said, but to all the signatories on the Declaration of Independence, they knew that's exactly what he meant, you know. And it's only been over the last 200 years that phrase has gradually come to include more and more of us. When it came to adopting the United States Constitution, okay, half the people that were members of the Constitutional Convention were slave owners. Okay. And they ensured that in the drafting of the original Constitution, the institution of slavery was enshrined legally in the document. So for instance, they wanted to be clearly understood that their slaves were not people, they were property, like livestock. Okay. However, when it came to deciding how big a state's delegation was going to be in the House of Representatives, which is based upon population size of the state, they insisted that the number of slaves in their states for every 5 slaves, they should be counted as 3 people, even though they weren't. So just an extraordinary case of hypocrisy being written into the Constitution. Other language in there that made it clear that the power of the federal government would never be used to bring slavery to an end. So there was furious debate in the Constitutional Convention, we learned 30 years later from James Madison's notes, over the question. What was eventually realized by not only the slaveholders who were there, but also the Northerners, the lawyers and the preachers and whatnot in New England, who felt that slavery was a vicious evil and that to allow it to take root in America would be basically sticking a knife in our own heart, you know, and they said so during the Constitutional Convention. At the end of the day, however, they realized that if they were going to fight, you know, that if they were going to hang together as a nation, you know, rather than devolving into civil war as soon as the Revolutionary War was over, that what really needed to happen was that we need to come together as a nation and form a national government, and that everybody that signed off on that Constitution knew that they were going to have to deal with the slavery question down the road. And then in 1861, after this, the nation became more and more and more divided over the question of slavery, you know, and the Confederate states basically said, well, we're out of here. You know, we don't need to be part of this club anymore. We're going to form our own nation. And the northern political leaders and the president decided that that really wasn't a very good idea at all, and that they weren't going to be allowed to do that. And so the Civil War ensued. And there are a lot of reasons that the Civil War was fought. It, you know, had to do with, you know, things like the industrial North versus the agricultural South, and who controlled all the capital, which was the bankers in the North, and the North and the national government not allowing the South to trade with Europe and whatnot. But you know, among the driving forces that nearly tore the country apart, it was a fight over slavery, over whether people could own each other as property. Okay. And it took a war to bring that institution to an end legally. So that's part of our karma, right? That's part of our history. We have these ideals that are enshrined in our legal documents, but we also had planted within it karmic seeds of hatred and greed that very nearly destroyed the country. And so that's sort of the legacy that we inherited going forward. And although slavery was made illegal by, you know, the amendments to the Constitution adopted after the Civil War, and civil rights statutes and whatnot, the kind of tension arising from the oppression, you know, of one ethnic group by another has been part of what stayed with us ever since.
Could you say just a little bit about the 100 years of Jim Crow after the Civil War?
Well, that's what I was referring to, right? You know, that even though the institution was legally abolished, certainly at the state level, it remained, you know, that kind of oppression, that kind of disproportionately disparate treatment, you know, remained very much in place, and it does till this day. Right? One of the classes that I teach in my day job right now is a course on law and society in the criminal justice program in the School of Public Affairs at CU Denver. And it's a graduate program for people that want to go into command levels of police departments or other law enforcement agencies, or parole probation officers and folks like that who want to work in criminal justice. And one of the things, because particularly because of some of the events that have been happening in suburban St. Louis recently, we're spending a lot of time now looking at, you know, what were the constituent ingredients that made possible what happened there. Okay. What were some of the, you know, we're still gathering facts about what actually happened on the ground. There are these competing narratives that the news media have, you know, have glommed onto. And if we look back in 20th century history of race relations in America, you know, we had terrible, deadly, bloody race riots happening in 1965 in LA, 1967 in Detroit, most of the major cities of the country after the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968. And then another explosion in South Los Angeles after the Rodney King beating in 1992. And just, you know, horrific self-inflicted wounds occasioned by, you know, these enormous racial tensions that flare up from time to time around the country. One of the things that I've actually come to appreciate, however, about some of the news media coverage is comparing what went on, what's been going on in that town, with what's happened elsewhere around the country when there have been incidents when police officers have shot to death people who turned out to be unarmed suspects, maybe hadn't even committed any crime. Some of the differences that happen are these, and then there've been a lot of interviews with big city police chiefs, including, you know, the ones in Los Angeles, where the city was ripped apart for days by vicious race, deadly race riots. Okay. Among the things that they do now, and one really important one, is community policing. Okay. Instead of police officers just patrolling neighborhoods in their cars, armed to the teeth, they get out and walk the streets and meet people. So they're understood to be part of the community rather than just an occupying force. Okay. They don't arm themselves to the teeth, you know, if it's not necessary to do so. And police departments like Los Angeles and a lot of other big cities, the demographic makeup of the police department, you know, the ethnic makeup of the police department is at least to some degree reflective of that of the community they serve. There's proactive, ongoing contact between police departments and community leaders. Okay. So that in the event something bad happens, those networks are already in place, those relations are already in place. So there are actually a lot of things that a lot of cities around the country have done in the wake of some of the really horrible things that have happened in American cities in the past to make things better than they were. Not that they're perfect. But I think that one of the problems when there's a flare-up like this that does happen in some place like Ferguson is that we tend to think, well, that's just America all over. And it's actually not. There have been a lot of painful lessons learned in the past from some of our own relatively recent history in this regard. And there have indeed been some serious changes made. So again, we can look at some of the heaviness of the social karma that we have inherited. But just as is the case with our relationship to our personal karma, okay, and coming to understand it as who we were at that point in time then, it's also possible to frame it or understand our own karma in the same way. You know, if you look at environmental issues, our dependence now on fossil fuels, you know, it's one of the things that helped make this a really powerful and technologically advanced nation. It's one of the things that right now is having the effect of boiling us in oil, right? So we can appreciate on the one hand the technological wizardry that made it possible for us to be where we are as an economy and a civilization, but also to realize that the side effects, you know, of our having gone down that path are now coming home to roost. You know, the karmic fruits of the reliance on that way of generating energy is being felt. We're increasingly feeling the negative side of it, the difficult side of it. It's tricky stuff. It's tricky stuff as we seek to apply the Dharma to some of the issues that are before us. I came across an essay recently by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who, you know, he's one of the foremost English language interpreters of, translators of the Pali Canon, teachings of the historical Buddha. Looking at, and he started an organization called Buddhist Global Relief, you know, to try to help those around the world who are being most ravaged by lack of access to adequate food, shelter, and clean water and medical care, especially those whose suffering is occasioned by climate change. And so he's a very erudite, highly regarded, very well respected and trusted scholar of the Dharma. And in his writings about what he sees as, you know, very close to the core of a lot of our issues, he said, well, you know, basically, I think it's global capitalism. He said the way we extract resources and the relative lack of any meaningful control over how that's done and the way we use them, you know, it's having the net effect of threatening, you know, the web of life on which we all depend. Dom Pedro Caldera, Archbishop of Buenos Aires, is it, or Bogota? Can't remember any. He said, when I ask for food for the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. And so, you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi is just, you know, with the authority of his teachings, you know, and is respected as a leader of scholarship on the teachings of the Buddha, how to apply them to daily life. He's just stepped right in the middle of it. He said there is something profoundly off, you know, that the entire system, the global system for the distribution of wealth and necessary resources, the way we use them, he said it's basically driven by institutionalized greed, you know, by rampant, unrestrained greed. And that any particular system for the distribution of wealth is not an end in and of itself. It's a means, it's a mechanism. Okay. And so if we want to really stop and think a little bit about what we really want out of this, you know, to end the suffering of all sentient beings, to see to each other's welfare, you know, to act with generosity, to act with kindness, to act with wisdom, then we need to look at the things that are really making that not possible. And one of the ones that he points out, you know, is institutionalized greed. Okay. A system that's simply based on exploitation, whether it's on the exploitation of resources or of other people. And so he's witnessing, you know, he's telling the truth of his own Dharma, you know, his understanding of the Dharma and how it applies to the way we're living our lives, you know, as individuals, as communities, as nations, as members of global civilization. And he's just kind of stepped out there. And he's not advocating necessarily an alternative form of doing things. He's saying that the way we're doing things now is sick, you know, and it's imperiling us. And we need to change the way we do things, you know, whether it's, you know, tinkering with the existing system or tossing it all over. He doesn't go there. He's not advocating a particular political movement, but he's calling out what he sees as ways of doing things now that might quite possibly lead to our destruction. It's controversial, you know. It's controversial for him to do. It's controversial for us to do, because, you know, we can have people, you know, who have sincerely held views, you know, about how things are and what ought to be done, both emerging from the same teachings of the Buddha, but manifesting themselves in different points of view. And I was pretty inspired by what he wrote, okay, because it's one of the first times that, you know, instead of just doing straight up Dharma, he's saying, look, you know, if sila means anything, you know, and it, the way he translates, you know, the term sila, you know, a wise speech, action, and way of life, you know. He said it's to live in harmony with. To live in harmony with oneself, to live in harmony with all sentient beings. Okay. To care for others as we would have them care for us. You know, and he said, if we really want to live the Buddha's teachings, it requires having a hard look at the way our society, our economies, our institutions are organized now, as to make that difficult, if not impossible. To call it out, to give it a name, to witness your understanding of the Dharma as these issues arise. So that applies to trying to bring some sense of generosity, kind regard to our reflection on or our participation in discourse on questions like race relations in the United States, certainly having to do with the environment, or any one of a variety of other issues that may come to mind. Okay. what it means to witness our Dharma, the truth of our understanding of these matters, okay? And to try to come at these issues in the same way, with the same kind regard, the same kind of insight that we relate to our own personal karma with. Okay? That is an art form. It's always going to be a work in progress. And we always have to go forward with a sure and certain knowledge that we will make mistakes. But we'll blow it, but it's still worth the effort. So, please, I invite any thoughts. Please, Gloria. Yeah.
I was wondering what the role of maybe sometimes not so skillful action happens in a collective karmic situation. For example, I saw the movie Cavalry the other night, and I got reminded just how angry they are in this case in Ireland at the church for all the abuse that was suffered. And
right.
I've been somewhat privy to that because my best friend was born in a mother birth home and essentially sold to a New York Catholic couple when she was 18 months old. And it's just, it's like suddenly the entire country is becoming aware,
mm-hmm.
and the response is anger. And it seems like collective anger has played a role, a positive role maybe, in these sort of karmic shifts. But it seems that odds with the Dharma.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of anger, that kind of rage, you know, is a natural karmic consequence of the way they were treated. Okay. If you look at the civil rights movement, for instance, there were many voices, there were many perspectives. You know, Martin Luther King's was certainly not the only one. You know, His movement, his approach, his discourse, I think, probably had greater moral force than many of the other organizations and their goals and whatnot at the time, because he was touching on universal values. He was touching on values that the Christian church professes but does not always live. You know, he was calling people to task for not living their faith, basically. And that was hugely influential. At the same time, here's also the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Black Panthers and a bunch of other folks that were coming at it from different directions with different tactics and in some cases different goals. So I should imagine within the Catholic nation, in addition to the sense of rage at having, you know, having entire generations of people in some way violated by an institution in which they had reposed their trust, I think that kind of anger is only to be sort of expected. Just as, you know, I cannot honestly tell you that I'm without anger when I think about things having to do with race relations, for instance, or with some of the stuff that's being done to the environment. Okay. For me, and sometimes I give voice to it, especially when I'm among friends, you know, I tend to just go all over the place in terms of radically unskillful speech. Having said that, what I've also come to understand that is that we who study the Dharma and seek to practice it have an opportunity to bring something new and different to the party. To the extent that we're able to actually apply the Buddha's teachings to these kinds of issues. Okay. I could, you know, clearly get out there and rage about, you know, all the kind of horrific sorts of suffering that I see being inflicted out there. And it would probably have the reaction, you know, the equal and opposite reaction in terms of those who hold different points of view. Sort of a self-canceling dynamic, or seek to bring to the discourse, the reflection, the interaction, a different voice, one that's based to some extent on insight into our past collective karma. You know, the Bill McKibben and his group, you know, 350.org and whatnot, one of their tactics is the moral shaming of the oil industry. and speaking about them in very, very disparaging terms, you know. Martin Luther King didn't talk about the Bull Connor and the, you know, and the Alabama state troopers as agents of evil, you know, or servants of the devil. Okay. He talked about them as being woefully misguided, you know, of almost the way Jesus talked about the Romans, you know, forgive them, they know not what they do, right? He was about forgiveness. And for me, with regard to the environment, for instance, you know, our karma, the karma we've inherited is that of a nation that's extraordinarily dependent upon fossil fuels, you know, for how we run things, for our wealth, you know, and that, for me, it needs to be understood and appreciated, even as it becomes increasingly important to give voice to the fact that we're doing ourselves terrible harm, you know, to the environment as a result. But to try to point that out in a way that seeks to awaken rather than to disparage the other, okay, that seeks to encourage some form of collective action, just as Martin Luther King did, okay, to right what appears to be a wrong, you know, and I'm not talking about a moral wrong as much as I am a wrong with regard to natural science. You know, we might well be in the process of making this planet unfit for human habitation, mm-hmm. just as we've already made it unfit for hundreds of thousands of species over the last 10 years or so, right? But to do that, to try to do it from a place of compassion is a big challenge, but I think it's worth the effort, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we suffer from collective denial, and I'll give two examples of it in our relationships with, like, the priest pedophilia issues and, like, racial relations. When Jeremiah Wright came out and they had that video of him saying, "I don't say God bless America, I say God damn America." Mm-hmm. And everybody was up in an uproar. But they had to know, because of his age and where he lived, mm-hmm. that he probably experienced lynchings, mm-hmm. and people being drug out into the streets. And Langston Hughes wrote a story about this black man who came back from World War I having served his country. You know the story?
Yeah, right.
Okay. And he was a violinist. Mm-hmm. And he toured the North, and he was the rage. And he went home to the South, and he was uppity. And they took him out, and they beat him up, and they tortured him, and they killed him, and they strung him up, and they burned his body. Mm-hmm. Because he was a successful black musician in the mm-hmm. South, mm-hmm. getting out of his mm-hmm. his place in the culture. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so why people would be so upset if Jeremiah Wright saying that, I think there's a collective denial. When I was a kid growing up, I can remember, like, an adolescent forward, I can remember seeing these films, like, and most of them, the ones that I'm remembering, were, they took place in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And it was like, there was always this undercurrent in the film that the Irish priest abused the boys. But no one, not a word. And I saw that and thought, well, is that just the way it is? Of course, now it's coming out. So people, I think people have been in collective denial about these things for decades, if not longer.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, we don't like to think of ourselves as a society that's really riven with these unresolved issues, you know, and yet we are. And so just as we seek to take responsibility for not replicating our own unwholesome karma personally, then there, likewise, to the extent we're willing to take it on, there's a certain responsibility for seeking to not replicate our unwholesome social karma as well. And oftentimes that involves more than silence. You know. Please.
So I did something last week that was unskillful. And so what is the best way to look at this? Should I apologize to the person or have compassion for myself for being that way at that point in time?
Oh, I don't see that as either or at all. All the above and more. Sure. I think that, and I think it's possible to render an honest apology from the perspective that we've been talking about this evening. You know, if you can see who you were at the point in time you did the unskillful thing, you can say, well, yeah, I was really overcome with ill will or anger or something, and you can just tell that person, you know, at that point in time, you know, I was feeling that, and that's why I spoke to you as I did or did what I did, and for that I apologize. That's called, in some circles, that's called karma cleaning. It's like smelting off the impurities from ore. Yeah, it's good. Thank you. Please.
The sense of self is so strong and permanent. It's just a cornerstone, at least for me, of my very existence. Mm-hmm. What techniques or suggestions would you have for beginning to relinquish that, mm-hmm. that permanence and idea of it being such a sense of self?
Sure. Insight meditation. That's one of the principal functions of insight meditation practice, which is to, you know, there is a Chinese emperor who was having difficulty grasping the Dharma as it was being taught to him by this monk. And so what the monk did was to create this room of 16 mirrors that faced each other, okay, and had the emperor stand in the middle of it. So he could see, he asked what he saw. Well, I see infinity, I see the entire universe. And he said, everywhere, in every direction I look, I also see myself. And so one of the things that you do when you're doing insight meditation practice is that you're basically taking your consciousness out of the room. Okay, it's like the consciousness is up in the corner someplace. And you can see yourself creating your world. You can see, you know, you can watch the I-making and the me-making process go on. You know, as you're sitting there and thoughts arise, emotions arise, you know, especially if there was some unpleasant event that happened where somebody said or did something that was harmful to you, you can reflect on that and you can have the factual memories of what occurred, and then what may follow that very soon is some sense of anger or resentment or whatnot, and then that can kind of build on itself. The Pali word for that is papancha, means proliferation, until you've got this whole drama that you're producing about some terrible thing that was done to you and what you're going to do in return and whatnot. And that's all just selfing in all its glory, you know? But at some point, when you're just really carefully watching what the mind is up to, you can see that that's what's happening. You know, that the mind is producing this movie, this great drama. And as soon as you see that that's what's going on, it's like pricking a balloon with a pin. What seems like substantial and shaped and colored and whatnot, poof, it's gone, right? And that is a process, you know, the Buddha talked about drops of water in a bucket, you know, and it's a cumulative thing and it can take a very long time. But that for every drop of mindfulness that is able to see the I-making and me-making process going on, to that extent, it begins to destabilize and disempower that very process. And that's why we call it practice. Okay.
I'm sitting here thinking I like the idea of the capitalism, mass capitalism, kind of being at the root of things, but it also seems like maybe, I don't know, that I-making, is that where the ego creates the fear that, I mean, it seems like we're being, as a group, we all get divided and conquered, and the only thing, you know, there's a lack of connection, there's a lack of clarity, and then it becomes really easy to always have this us and them kind mm-hmm. of conversation going on. There's not, you know, there's so much fear that we're constantly defending who we are, whatever we're looking at the moment, and it just seems like that's kind of a rolling theme, at least in the Western Hemisphere. But does that come from the I-making and the me-making? I know a lot of it comes from outside, but is that the antidote to that as well?
When, you know, in books like Buddha's Brain, when Rick Hansen talks about the hardwiring that we have as a species, you know, to seek pleasure and avoid pain and live under the illusion that we can live forever, okay? That's, you could think of that as our kind of genetic karma, you know, that's the wiring we've got. And one way of understanding, you know, some of the issues that we have in the world right now is that, just as is the case with us as individuals, when that hard wiring is infused with too much energy and it's not being morally regulated in some way or another, that's where greed, hate, and delusion come from. You know, it's the exponents of those things, you know, driven beyond, you know, the old German root of the word evil is exceeding due measure, beyond reasonable balance. So it's like these forces driven beyond reasonable bounds, you know. It happens to us individually, it can happen to cultures, to communities, and it can happen globally, okay. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, I do not believe, is a communist. What he's saying is that unregulated global capitalism as it's currently being practiced is tearing us apart environmentally, and that we need to do something about it. You know, he's not opposed to economic development and whatnot, but that particular energy or force has just gotten out of hand and is threatening us, as well as other sentient beings, other species. And that applying the Dharma to that is indeed possible, and it can work. And I think you correctly assessed, just as he did, that things seem kind of out of hand right now. That things really do seem to be driven mostly by craving and by ill will, you know, between different groups. Please, one last before we go. Yes, please.
I mean, just getting back to karma. When you're talking about sort of the collective karma, when you're talking about racism in this country, it just sounds like you're talking about this huge wound that, you know, we carry for a long time. And it seemed to me like the way that the Buddha addressed that was he talked about sankharas, and he talked about those psychic wounds that we have in our system. And I guess I'm just curious, sort of what he said about sankharas. How do you resolve this?
Right. The sum total of our memories and the emotions associated with them. In terms of the practice of sila, in terms of words, deeds, his response was the creation of sangha, Buddhist sanghas, right? The monastic sangha. You know, there were violent. Race relations extant throughout India at the time that he lived and taught, mostly occasioned by the caste system. And so he said, in my spiritual community, there shall be no caste. Everybody is the same, no matter what the color of their skin. Okay. And there aren't going to be uniforms, and there's not going to be ranks and whatnot. What we're going to do is we're going to take clothes, old clothes, worn out clothes that people threw away, and we're going to stitch them together, and, you know, we're going to, he was one of the sort of first recyclers, right? And we're going to dye them with the dyes that are found in the clay, you know, in the riverbanks where they live, you know, ochre and russet and whatnot. And he said, and that's it. We're all going to shave our heads, you know, male or female, He did not in his lifetime because he was up against some really powerful patriarchal forces, did not manage to equate the same rights to women in the Sangha as he did to men. But other than that, his was a radical spiritual community. I mean, he lived his teachings in that way, and time and again in his teachings, he called out the caste system. You know, he said, yeah, this is unwholesome. This is causing suffering. So that's how he did it. And so I think that to the extent that we find opportunities to call out our own caste system, it might not be such a bad thing. We've run out of time, folks. Let's spend just one moment sitting together again. Going forth, may we all be safe from inner and outer harm. May we open to the joy that is within us and be happy. May we rest in silence and stillness, at peace with things as they are. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free.